So I've just finished teaching a short retreat at Spirit Rock that started, I suppose it started Wednesday evening and ended yesterday morning. And at the end of a retreat like that, or most retreats, last morning, there's a little bit of discussion about how to practice outside of the retreat, how to take care of oneself leaving a retreat, because a retreat is often quite different than daily life. And many people find themselves struggling to get into the retreat. I mean, once they're there, a lot of struggle and wondering why they came. But by the end of the retreat, they don't want to go back. They're not so eager to go back to where they came from often, because of the stillness of the mind, the calmness of the mind, the valuing the peace and the things that the sensitivity that arises, the open-heartedness that can arise. So there's all kinds of things we say, and I surprised myself a little bit by taking that occasion to talk about those things a little bit indirectly, and to talk about bowing, and somehow bowing being a topic that would somehow help people, the integration of retreats and leaving a retreat and daily life and how to take care of themselves. And I'm still a little bit then, still resonating in me, the idea of bowing. And so I would like to take the occasion today to continue on that topic. There is a saying that I don't know where it comes from, that if there's no bowing, it's not Buddhism. If there's no bowing, it's not Buddhism. And I kind of like that. And when I was thinking about that, what popped up into my mind is I sometimes get asked, what's the difference between Buddhism and psychotherapy? And that's, of course, a big topic that there's many overlaps and differences. But a very simple one is, as far as I know, and I haven't seen all the different schools of psychotherapy and how all therapists operate, but I'm not familiar with therapists ever teaching their clients to bow or that bowing is valuable, and that bowing, you know, expresses something profound. So if there's no bowing, it's not Buddhism. Jack Kornfield tells a story that when he was a monk in Thailand, he said, they did so much bowing that he said, if it moved, we bowed. When I was a monk at Tassajara Zen Monastery, my motto or my policy was, when in doubt, bow. And because back then, the reason for that motto was there was so much bowing there also, so much ritual, and sometimes it was quite elaborate. And you didn't always know what to do in these choreographed rituals of Zen. And so if in doubt, just bow. Certainly, you probably wouldn't go wrong in the ceremony. And at Tassajara, we would often bow to each other on the path. The instruction when I was there was when people passed each other and just walking on the road or the path of Tassajara, you'd stop and bow and then continue. And it was a little bit of a hassle because you're always walking around and always passing people. And I noticed sometimes people would kind of walk around the long ways. They wouldn't have to bow. But I realized recently that this motto of mine, you know, when in doubt, bow, has much more profound implications than just, you know, if you're in a ceremony and you don't know what to do, then bow. When you're uncertain, when you're filled with doubt, you can always bow. Bow to your doubt, bow to the situation. When in Zen practice in Japan, where they do a lot of bowing, they have this morning service, chanting in the morning they do after the morning zazen. And the tradition for probably centuries in Japan is that before the morning chanting begins, there's three full prostrations to the floor towards the Buddha. Everybody does it together. And then at the end of that morning session of chanting, there's another three full bows. It marks the beginning and ending of that chanting session. A lot of Westerners have a lot of trouble with bowing. And maybe partly because some people come from Protestant or Jewish backgrounds where idol worship or something like that is not so appreciated. And all kinds of reasons why bowing, you know, is kind of foreign to many Westerners and they'd rather not. It's also perhaps a little bit against the grain of certain kind of Western American individualism, kind of a self-centered approach, and I can do it myself or I'm whatever. And the idea of bowing below to something and maybe actually all the way to the floor. And the custom in Zen is when you bow full prostrations, you bow all the way to the floor with, and then you touch your forehead on the floor. And as your forehead touches the floor, you lift your palms of your hand up over your ears. And the idea is that you have the Buddha standing on your hands and you're lifting the Buddha above you, like that, above your head. And for Westerners, that's, you know, the idea of doing that much to someone else is kind of hard. I believe my understanding of Indian and Southeast Asian culture, where that kind of idea originated from, there's a very strong hierarchy of your body parts, of what is purer than other body parts. And the feet are not among the purest parts of your body. The head is among the purest. And the last thing you want to do in Thai culture, one of the last things, maybe there's other things that are worse, but is to touch someone on their head, especially someone you don't know. It's very insulting because their head is kind of like the purest part of their body and you don't want to touch the top of their head with your hand. And also the last thing you want to do in a traditional Indian or Southeast Asian, probably any religious culture, not just Buddhist, but Buddhist culture, is stick your feet out at a Dharma teacher. Because, and so remember, if an Asian teacher comes and teaches here, like we had Sister Susila a few weeks ago, I noticed some feet were pointing towards her. I think that it would be really good if you remembered not to do that, not think, you know, just out of politeness for what they're used to and their culture and their understanding. I don't mind. I once led a retreat, and a 10-day retreat, and this guy sitting right here in front of me, just like where you're sitting, decided, I guess, he was going to lay down, kind of rest his back or something. And so I continued, you know, holding forth. And after a while, he started snoring. So all I needed to do was lean forward, and because he's right in front of me, right, and just kind of wiggle his pig toe. So anyway, in Asia, you wouldn't probably do that. So there's all kinds of reasons why in the West, why some people have difficulty with the idea of bowing. So Suzuki Roshi in these three bows. So in Japan, you do three bows before this morning service. So when Suzuki Roshi was in America for a while, he had Americans do nine bows before the morning service. Because he felt Americans really needed to bow. And certainly the challenge of bowing, you know, is good to deal with the challenge at least and kind of confront what's going on there. Suzuki Roshi said something like, bowing and meditation are the same. Both of them help overcome our self-centeredness. So this idea of overcoming self-centeredness as a, you know, so what are you willing to bow to? What do you bow to? Is a very interesting question. I asked that question of a friend of mine today who has a lot of trouble bowing, and she kind of was very proud of the fact that she goes to a little bit informal traditional Buddhist meditation center where people bow. She says, you know, I don't bow. That's why I can leave so quickly before at the end of the event, because everyone's bowing to the floor and I just, you know, get up and leave. So I asked her, what do you bow to? And then she stopped for a minute, and then she actually had something to say. There was something she bowed to. Another thing I learned about bowing in my many years of practice was also at Tassajara. I was there at this Zen monastery for about 3 years, and we did a lot of bowing. And the bowing was the rule. I mean, you live there, you live that life, you enter that monastic life. You have to participate in the rules and rituals of the life, otherwise why stay there? And so there was just a lot of bowing. When in doubt, bow. And I counted once how many times I bowed from the time I woke up in the morning around 4:30 to until I think it was 10 o'clock in the morning. And I got to something like 54 times I had bowed. Just you know, that segment of the day. And so I just did it, you know. And one principle of Tantra, Tantric Buddhism, which is very ritual-oriented in parts of it, is that the enacting of certain gestures, certain movements with your body, the embodying of certain kind of things you do with your body, affects your inner life, your psychophysical life. And if you take a posture or do an activity of a Buddha or some kind of mythological archetypal figure, somehow what you do with your posture then affects your inner life, reconditions it in some way. So with all this bowing that we did, you know, I did it. I wasn't that into bowing when I started there. You know, just they told me to do it, so fine, I'll do it. So I just did it. But I noticed that slowly, because of all the times we bowed over and over and over again, very slowly, I noticed that it somehow changed me on the inside. And I was also being changed on the inside by all the other practices we were doing there, the meditation and the life there. But I noticed that it was changing, and after a while, I noticed that when I bowed, because it was the rule to bow, that something was being born inside of me, some form of expression, some kind of feeling, some kind of attitude was being born. And as I continued bowing, that attitude or feeling became stronger and stronger. And if I had gone around Tassajara, and every time I ran into someone, I'd given them a good old, you know, howdy doody, or good old, you know, just shook their head, you know, high five, or given them, you know, shook their hand in a good kind of egalitarian way, that it would have been really great. It would have been a nice feeling, a nice sense of community, and wonderful things. But it evokes a different kind of feeling inside. If you do the same thing over and over again, different kind of thing is born. And the idea of bowing, I found, for me personally, I found it resonated or arose out of a place that I think is a lot deeper inside of me than the kind of place I come to when I shake hands or high five, or my son likes to do high ten. And so what is that? What is it that's evoked when we bow down, reach down like this and bow, tip our head a little bit, put our hands in front of our hearts? And I think there's many different things that are expressed in that gesture. In different situations, different things are called for, different expressions. One of the primary ones I think of for myself is I think of gratitude and appreciation. At the end of meditation, it's a time I often want to do this, because somehow, even when meditation is difficult, at the end of it, I often have a feeling of gratitude and appreciation. And when you have feelings like that, it's often wonderful to give expression to them. And if sometimes when things aren't given expression, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like they haven't really come alive yet, or they're a little bit truncated, or their full potential hasn't been reached. And so I find it really wonderful, the end of sitting, just to go like this. The question then is, what are you bowing to? For me, that's an irrelevant question. Just somehow, what am I grateful for? What am I appreciative for? The way I feel at the end of the meditation, I actually would prefer not to say what it's for. Maybe it's gratitude without an object. Is there such a thing? Appreciation without an object, without a reason? Just this feeling of gratitude, feeling of appreciation. And it's nice just to do it. Suzuki Roshi said that when you bow to, his idea was that when you bow to a Buddha image, you're really bowing to yourself. And I like that idea a lot. Because the Buddha is just, you know, this is just a wooden statue here. It's a nice one, but it's, you know. And so what are we bowing to when we bow to a Buddha? He says you're bowing to yourself. And why would you bow to yourself? Why would you bow down, lower the mast of conceit, lower your self-centeredness, and bow to yourself? Isn't that a wonderful paradox? You know, that you're so worthy of being bowed to, you're willing to let go of your own conceit and self-centeredness. I mean, you know, so that kind of twists the mind a little bit, doesn't it? You know, if I told you you have to let go of your self-centeredness because it's a good spiritual, moral thing to do, you'd come all the reasons why maybe it's good to be self-centered. But if I told you, let go of your self-centeredness so you can really honor yourself deeply, really offer great respect to yourself, then, I don't know, maybe would that confuse you? Or would that kind of get your attention or wake you up? Or what did it do? So bowing to yourself, bowing to your potential to wake up, bowing to that part of yourself which can be at peace, bowing to that part of yourself which can be without conflict with the world and yourself, bowing to that part of yourself which can be filled with love for the world or compassion for the world or sensitive to concerns of the world. There's all this wonderful qualities within us that we can live by that for the most part most people don't live by, or they don't live by very much. And part of a spiritual life, I think, is awakening some of these qualities and so that they're more readily available and part of our life as we go about. And bowing, I think, is one of those ways to acknowledge those things and to help support them and evoke them. We bow for out of respect. I think it's one of the more traditional reasons to bow, out of respect to others. Bowing a respect for them, bowing to the... Some people like to say bowing to the divinity within them. Not exactly a Buddhist idea too much, but that which is sacred within them, perhaps. Some kind of real appreciation of something profound in the other person. And so it's a recognition of something. So when I bow to... Sometimes I like to shake hands with people. It seems like just the right thing to do. But sometimes I like to bow. And when I bow, I usually feel like I'm bowing to something much more deeper in the person than I'm connecting to when we're shaking hands. You know. And paradoxically, oddly enough, if I'm in conflict with someone, and really angry with them or pissed off or something, you know, I might find it actually kind of difficult to shake hands with them. But I think I can always find something to bow to them. There's something I'm willing to do that to people. And it isn't because it's second best, but I think because somehow it reminds me to connect to something within myself and something in the other person that somehow bypasses the difficulties I have and the interpersonal conflicts and stuff like that. Some Buddhist teachers like to emphasize that when you bow, you put your hands together flat. And what you're doing is you're overcoming duality. Duality of self and other, duality of subject and object, duality of good and bad, various kinds of dualities. And I like the idea that when you bow, you actually keep your hands a little bit open, a little bit apart like this. And there's different ways of bowing. You can bow, you put your hands, like in Zen, they put your hands up like this high. But I like to do it a little bit in front of your chest. And you put your hands together like this and have them a little bit open. And it's kind of like representing the heart that's a little bit open. And as you tip forward, your full heart is spilling over for the person you're bowing to. One Zen teacher I know said that when you bow, you're tipping your head forward, and so you're opening up your head and spilling out all your self-centered ideas. So either way works. And so that's about all I think I wanted to say. It's a little talk so far, but a little talk about bowing. And I wanted to hear from you all, if you had any comments or thoughts about bowing or any questions about that that you like, or anything else. Yes?
A comment and a question. Handshake developed as a way of showing that you didn't have a weapon. So it is a way of kind of agreeing not to harm. A bow is much more that of respect, so that one is kind of removing the negative, the other one is, in my mind, creating a positive.
Interesting.
The other question is, often I have something in my hands, and there's no place to put it down when I wish to bow. Is there any protocol or guidance for those situations? Not to walk around with things in your hands?
Well, you know, it doesn't have to be literally putting the hands together. If you're holding something, you can just keep holding it and then bow down like this. In Zen, they would often put their, if you're small enough, you'd put it in between between your thumb and your fingers, like this, and then so you can still put your hands together. But like this works pretty well, you know. But generally, I think if you have something in your hands and you're going to bow, what you want to do is to at that point hold the thing with both hands. So even though you can easily hold it with one hand, and you could, I guess, you bow your head like this somehow. But the respectful thing to do is to somehow bring your hands together. So they're not actually touching each other, but at least you're holding the object with both hands when you bow. So you're more of you is engaged in it. The idea, I think, for part of the idea of bowing for me is that you want to bring your whole self into that activity. And if you're kind of like one hand kind of dangle to the side, you're not all into it. You're not all involved. So putting your hands together is, you know, in some way.
Actually, I have a question. I've bowed to some of the monastics who have come to visit, and they haven't bowed back. And I didn't know whether that was a Theravadan tradition or kind of what's up with that.
Maybe some of you know better than I, but my understanding of that is that they're not supposed to bow to us lay people, because I'm not sure. I whatever I say, take with a grain of salt. I'm not sure if I can represent it so well. But see, traditional Buddhist culture, which is very much, I think, like much traditional Indian culture, is there's a very strong an important element of it is kind of hierarchical thinking. And so there's a lot of different status. People have different status. And some people are more respect-worthy than others, or more higher status than others. And that's, you know, we have in India the caste system, for example. But this idea of this kind of hierarchical thinking also comes to play then in Buddhism. And so that being a monastic is considered such a virtuous, worthwhile life in its own right, that it's more worthy, it's more respect-worthy or something than a lay life. And so a Buddhist monastic bows to other monks. A Buddhist monastic bows to the Buddha. But a Buddhist monastic wouldn't bow to anybody who's lower in the hierarchy. So a Buddhist monk is not supposed to bow to a king, for example. Because even a king, who, you know, great emperor who rules all of India, is not of the same status as someone who's a novice monk, a new monk. Now this raised big problems when Buddhism went to China and started getting established in China, because China was built also on a hierarchical system, with basically in the human world the emperor was on the top, and so to have these monks show up who wasn't going to bow to the emperor, that was kind of awkward. And so they had to work through that. But in India, they didn't have to. You know, it was pretty well established. So I believe it's something to do with that. And but next time one comes, ask them directly, and get their answer. It'd be interesting to hear. Does someone else have a better answer, a better understanding of that phenomena than me? Why monks don't bow to back? Yeah.
Not an answer. When the Dalai Lama was here, it seemed like he could hardly get off stage and bow to the people. Now, there were monks there, but also when anyone came before him, he used to bow very deep.
There's a lot of different kinds of monks in Buddhism. And there's different orders of Tibetan Buddhism, there's different orders of Mahayana Buddhism, there's different orders of Zen Buddhism, just like there's the Benedictines and the Franciscans and all that. And in some ways, the differences are even greater. And so within these different schools and different orders, they have different rules and stuff. And so it's the Theravadins who have this little bit of thing, which seems very unusual here for us in the West, a little bit odd. Yeah, please.
Now in the modern Indian culture, there's also still a very much a hierarchy about who bows to whom. So even in the lay life, young children would bow to the elders, but the elders will not bow back to the children. But whenever somebody of a lower hierarchy bows to you, they're supposed to give them a blessing or a good wish. So is that true of any Buddhist sect today? That the layperson bows to the monk and the monk gives a blessing. You know, it's like a momentary, it's like just a hand reached kind of above it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that at all. I've never gotten a blessing from a Buddhist monk in all my times, exactly. But however, the only time I got a real blessing was I went in Calcutta to visit Deepama, and Deepama was one of the was an Indian woman who was one of the most highly realized people in our particular meditation tradition coming out of Southeast Asia. She had studied in Burma in the same places. Joseph and Sharon and I and different people practiced, and she wasn't even a monastic, little woman. She lived by American standards, it would be kind of a ghetto tenement in Calcutta, but that probably it wasn't. There are more ghettos than where she lived. I was in India, I went in my pilgrimage to go see her because she was considered such like a saint. So I made my way up to a little tenement apartment building, went up these little narrow steps up to where she was, and I went to see her. And I don't remember anything we talked about, but I do remember that I sat kind of at her feet, and she put her hands on my head. So maybe it's an Indian custom to give me a blessing. And then I remember leaving, and it was the rainy season. My monsoon had started that afternoon. While I was visiting, I was being blessed, I guess. And I had to walk, and I stepped out of her apartment building, and the streets were flooded. And flooded meant that the... So there's a lot of things that are a little bit hard to bow to, but, to bow to everything, but you don't know what to do. Bowing is a great thing to do when things seem hopeless. You can always bow. You bow to that which is your teacher. Not your teacher, not your person is your teacher, but the thing which is your teacher. And when things are really challenging and really difficult, even hopeless, and feel like you can't even cope in the situation, you don't even know how to find your way forward, you can always bow. And you bow to that because it's your teacher. And how is it your teacher? That's for you to find out. What is it teaching there? But when you can't do anything else, the teaching is to let go. Oh, I have to let go. And even here, I have to let go of. Even this, I have to accept. Even this. Imagine. The world is like this, and I'm living in the middle of this. And I have to accept this. I don't like it. I wish it could be different. If I could change it, I would. But I have to accept this too. If I don't, I'm going to suffer a lot more. Suffer more than necessary. So even this is my teacher, and that it's teaching me to let go of my ideals, my things I hold on to, my conceit, my pride, all these different things. So the idea that bowing is lowering the mast of conceit, lowering our self-centered ideas, is a very important one, I believe. That's part of one of the things that's being done. And what I want to say along these lines is a very common teaching in Buddhism, but for those of you who haven't heard it, I think it's very profound. I think humility is a very important quality of Buddhist practice. I think that learning to be humble, learning to a certain level of humility, I think is essential. There's no Buddhist practice without some kind of humility arising. However, humility means... I like the word humility, but I have a little bit different meaning for it than maybe what comes to mind for you when you hear the word. I think of humility as being no longer comparing yourself to others. It's not, humility is not, saying you're less than others or you don't count. But it's no longer playing the game that you're better with others, better than others, that you're worse than others. And also, paradoxically, that you're not equal to others, or oddly enough. And that the Buddhist teachings on conceit is that there's three kinds of conceit, each of them as much poison as the other. And the conceit that you're superior, the conceit that you're inferior, and the conceit that you're equal to. And for American society as a general, the third one perhaps is the most challenging because we have a society that wants everyone to be equal. And if you're not equal and you're not superior, not inferior, then who are you? Well, you're someone who doesn't make the comparisons. You don't play the game. And that belongs, I think, the realm of humility, being humble. not making comparisons. Yeah?
I become aware that since we moved to this building, I don't see this space that we walk into here as something that inspires me. Now, I'm aware that in Spirit Rock, because of the door is into a meditation hall, you physically stop to do something, open the door, push the door, and you turn and bow. And I just haven't connected on any sort of ritual when I walk in. What helps?
I don't know. I don't know if it needs to be any different.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely that's a difference between Spirit Rock and here, and there is a loss and there's a gain in not bowing. There's also a gain. One of the gains is that I feel is very important being an urban center like this, is that it makes it a lot less intimidating for people to come in, for whom bowing is strange and foreign, and you know, what's this going on, and what am I participating in? And not having the bowing, you know, just means that people can come and feel relaxed who they are, and you know, to kind of put their body in some strange position without understanding what they're doing. And so I've never established that bowing as anything that anybody needs to do here. And sometimes people ask, you know, I look around, I see other people at the end of sitting bowing like this. And, you know, what's that about? Am I supposed to do that too? As far as I know, I hope it's the case, people are doing it because they feel like it, not because they feel like they should do it. And sometimes I do it and sometimes I don't. I think lately I've been doing it more. But for a period I didn't do it at all because, now I do it because I can't help myself. But for a long time I didn't do it at all, partly because I didn't want to set the precedent for other people. Now there's also a loss, because bowing is such a profound practice and so helpful that there's a real loss. And I'm trying to make amends here a little bit tonight by giving this talk. Mark.
I took Aikido for a number of years. And in Aikido, you're like bowing all the time. You bow when you enter the dojo, you bow when you leave the dojo. There's a wonderful group bowing where everybody bows at once at the beginning of practice and claps. And it's very powerful. And each individual training you're doing with somebody, you bow to them before you practice. You bow to them when you finish that practice. And I found myself just getting in the habit in strange places, bowing as I'm walking in the door and leaving because of that habit. But I remember one time we had a dojo group up in La Honda, and there was a Jewish man who came in, and he had a lot of trouble with the bowing. And he, you know, they told him he didn't have to, but it troubled him so much that he stopped coming because of that. And I felt very bad, because it's a wonderful practice that would have, you know, been a benefit for him. But I understood it, because being Jewish as a child, we were taught that people would die rather than bow before kings or idols. And that, in a way, not bowing was a way of honoring God and staying true to your commitment. So at the same time of being sad about that, I kind of understood it. It's strange how culturally we attach so much meaning to doing or not doing.
Right. And it's possible that bowing in ancient, you know, Palestine, or ancient, you know, Israel, had a very different meaning than what bowing means in India. But it's the same gesture, but it's a different meaning. And so the confusion is that it looks the same, and so I can't do it. Maybe. Yes?
I find it disturbing, quite frankly. I was feeling good when we were talking about bowing and having the heart kind of pour through your hands, but then all of a sudden you hear that monks don't bow to lay people, people blessed of lower caste, and I'm starting to feel better with a handshake. I know that for us, you know, as president, one of the first things they talked about when they named the president of the United States, when they decided George was going to be king, was whether or not people should still bow before him, and or curtsy or kneel or whatever. And they said no, to make it egalitarian, equal, that you would always shake that person's hand. And, you know, as your comment was about, you know, pulling out your hand so you weren't showing a gun. But I was feeling great until I started hearing history about monastics don't have to bow. That doesn't show a lot of humility on their part, I don't think.
Well, they bow to their superiors. They bow to their superiors.
Right.
It's a very important point. Good point you're making. I also feel uncomfortable with that parts of Buddhism. There's a lot. Buddhism is a huge, complex ecology event, and there's as any religion is. You know, it's as diverse as Christianity is diverse, for example. And so there are parts of Buddhism that I'm not comfortable with, and parts that I am. And so, in relationship to bowing, there are customs related to bowing that I don't care so much for, and I'm quite content to leave those aside. And there's customs of bowing that I think are very profound and wonderful. It might help a little bit that I was trained initially in the Zen tradition, which did not participate in this Theravadan monastic kind of thing. There the priests and the monks bowed to everyone equally, and there was no sense of there of higher and lower in that way. And so that was how I was introduced to it, was through the Japanese tradition. And I think a lot of Westerners are introduced to it without any association to that, either the monastic community's peculiar thing that they have. Let them do what they, that's their problem. You know, I don't care what they do. There's a lot of problems monastics have that I don't feel like I have to get involved in. and that part of Indian culture, Buddhism comes out of Indian culture, but there are parts of Indian culture which, for better or worse, I shouldn't say this, but I feel uncomfortable with some aspects of probably every culture, say it that way. One of the things that happens in America is that Buddhism is certainly, to some degree, picking and choosing those elements of Asian Buddhism that they want to have here. So it's a kind of reinventing the animal. But I think every generation does that for itself. And that happens in Asia also. Every generation there also. It's just much more dramatic here what we're doing. So I would encourage you, if there's something that you find valuable in the discussion of bowing or in bowing, something like that, don't destroy that, because just in some little corner of the tradition, there's some aspect of bowing which troubles you or you don't like. Just feel sorry for those people.
Sorry.
Yes.
So, like Mark, I've been speaking in the tradition of bowing through Aikido, and sometimes, like if I'm in a store and a clerk's been really helpful, I'll have this urge to bow, say thank you, and I usually stop myself because I think, how are they going to react? Are they going to think I'm weird? Are they going to get freaked out by just kind of bowing to them? Does this ever come up for you in your day-to-day life?
It does, and sometimes I'll withhold the urge because it seems like it's make the person uncomfortable. But even so, sometimes I find myself doing it spontaneously anyway, besides myself, because of the deep feeling I have. And no one's ever been offended. It just seems like it's just, especially here in California, I think there's kind of a lot of things which are kind of a lot of things which are kind of creeping into the culture, so it's probably pretty safe. But I remember when I left Sahara after living there for 3 years, and we did all this bowing. The first day I was gone, I left. I was in College Avenue in Berkeley, and I was just walking down the street by myself. And in Sahara, you bow to everyone you passed. And there were a lot of people there walking on College Avenue, and I had this urge to want to bow to all of them. But I felt it wasn't appropriate, but I felt this building inside, this pressure inside of me with all these people, right? And then, fortunately, I saw half a block away across the street this woman who'd spent a few weeks at Sahara during the summer. And I ran off after her and said, wait. I need someone to bow to. who'll understand. Yes?
I was going to say that one of the things that's occurring in this conversation is that we're lucky enough to have so many influences, that it's a very mixed thing, and lots of different sort of reasons why people sort of bow in different sort of traditions or cultures. And then thrown into that, I think, is this history in the U.S. of servitude and bowing too, which is one that is pretty charged, I think, for a lot of people as well. But it's sort of interesting to hear, that we're we're surrounded by so many different meanings, and that I think that kind of, for me, part of the reason it makes me a little unsure, like, I might know my reasons for it, but I have no idea how it will be interpreted, and maybe I shouldn't worry about it, but, you know, let's think about it.
It's true with almost anything, right? Even some of the words we use, you know. You know, I really believe in democracy, and you go, yeah, yeah. And, you know, we think we're talking about the same thing, right? But I think, you know, one of the things I hope that you maybe will think about as you leave this talk is bowing is a form of expression, like a word, like, and so if you want to have it, I hope you would include it as in your vocabulary. Of things that you, how you talk or how you express yourself. And when and where you bow is up to you. But I hope that, you know, somewhere it's in your vocabulary so that, you know, you would think maybe sometime you'd use it to express something that's sincere and meaning for you without hopefully too much worry about what it means for the other person. And or maybe something you do privately, maybe not towards another person at all, but it's something you do completely in your own privacy of your own life. It's sometimes, you know, I do it sometimes when no one's around even. Just something wells up and, you know. And it's, yes.
First reacted terribly badly to bowing because I grew up in a world where everybody was Christian, including my poor grandparents, although my parents were renegades. And I went to Sunday school, and I associated bowing with bowing your head and you know, praying like that, from the neck down like that. And it wasn't until I discovered that here, bowing is from the hips. And it felt entirely different. And, mm-hmm. and then I realized, oh, it's just not the same at all.
I read some years ago, a description of the origin of the Christian gesture like this of praying. And it was some archaeological study, I guess, something that back in ancient Roman days, I don't know if this is true or not, but this was the study, is that it's mimicking the hand posture of prisoners or slaves when they were bound. So this idea of, you know, handshaking is showing you're harmless, don't have a weapon in your hand. This is showing that you're kind of maybe bound to the divine, or you know, you're a servant, you know, or something. So there's all these different meanings that, you know, come through, and but I don't think most modern day Christians need to concern themselves with what Christians 2,000 years ago were doing when they were adopting, or ancient Romans were doing when they adopt certain things. I think things evolve and change the meaning and associations, so that bowing means something like for Buddhists, you know. Some areas of Buddhism mean something, one thing, and other areas it means something else. And things evolve and change. Yes?
In my readings, I came across some antidotes. And I recall bowing is an antidote for arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And it suddenly, it the sense to me, arrogance is such a binding, it won't allow you to learn, to be open to anything, and bowing seemed to open that up experientially, you know, so that it was teachable, you know, and the you know that you mentioned that posture where you raise your hands above your head. I you know, there have been times in my life, of course, when I gave up. I mean, I gave up. And when you really give up, you just kind of fall to the floor. And it seems much more appropriate if when you hit it, you do that. And it's just giving up and putting aside arrogance, allowing it to, like this antidote. I've always thought of it like that since I've been
great.
My own experience.
Great. Thank you very much for that. And maybe that's a good note to end on, is that if in one of those very rare occurrences where you somehow accidentally find yourself being arrogant, you might consider then. So anyway, out of wonderful appreciation and gratitude for all of you and for being here this evening, I bow to you all. Thank you.